Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon, the tabletop role-playing podcast that helps game masters learn new games and make each one better than the last. I am Brian Flaherty, and this season we set sail on the rustling waves in the Wild Sea. We encountered massive leviathans, magical whispers, and all manner of strange and complex characters. And now, with the season fading into the horizon, I am joined once again by this season's GM, or Firefly, Elliot Davis.
Hello!
And the designer of the Wild Sea, Felix Isaacs. Welcome to the show.
That's me.
never been great at greetings.
Felix, to start this off, I'm going to ask you the broadest question of the interview. How did we do?
Well, I mean,
I strongly feel all criticism should be constructive, but sometimes it's just so hard. No, you did a fantastic job. I loved it. I had a great time. You managed to make it, because I knew going into this that it would be a very dramatic presentation of the Wild Sea, which is one of the reasons I was excited about it in the first place. But you managed to make it dramatic in a way that a lot of the core systems still showed through, which is fantastic, and that it really showcased some bits, not just of the world as written, but of the characters as developed. And that's what I like the most when playing the Wild Sea myself. It's seeing how people take those bits from the book, make their characters, and then they kind of grow and change, and things are defined and redefined as time goes on. And that's the stuff that really shone, and that's the stuff I like the most. So yeah, you knocked it out of the park. You did a great job.
Hell yeah.
Thank you very much.
We'll take it. We'll roll around that compliment. And while I'm busy rolling around that compliment, Elliot, what did you think of the Wild Sea?
Oh, I mean, no notes. I loved it. I had so much fun running the system.
I thought this was the bit where you were going to say it was rubbish. How did you guys do? Oh, brilliant. What was the game like? Oh, that was crap.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I had to do so much work to make up for all the trash in that book. But no, I mean, total credit to you, Felix. I mean, this game runs like a dream. I mean, it was so much fun to run. Especially the twists and whispers and the sort of balance between GM and player control of the story just made for such fun emergent storytelling, which is what I love about doing AP and playing games in general. And so, yeah, it was amazing. It was so fun to play in this world and sort of make our own version of it. So, yeah, no notes.
No, really glad.
All right, we got all the fun stuff out of the way. Now, Felix, tell us.
Yes.
What did we fuck up? So there are a lot of rules in all the games that we play. And we use some, we don't use some, we use some creatively. We definitely took some liberties with certain mechanics. But as far as representing the system mechanically, how did you feel we did as a show?
So I think this is actually kind of important to say. One of the things that I champion on the Discord a lot when people are talking about the weight of rules in the Wild Sea, because it's not a particularly rules heavy game, but it is a bit crunchier than a lot of narrative focused games, because it has its roots in some stuff that is a lot crunchier than the kind of the current crop of fiction first stuff. And people do occasionally say, like, oh, but I don't think I'm going to remember like X, Y, and Z. And it's like, well, if you don't remember it, it doesn't, like, don't bother about it. Just don't use it. I don't care.
Right.
Like, I'm a designer. There's no higher authority telling you, like, if you want to ignore this bit of the game, you can. I think that should be true of every game, but it's particularly true of the Wild Sea, because I'm the one that wrote it, and I'm the one sitting here telling you, if that bit doesn't jive for you, or if you just can't remember that bit in those moments where flow is important, don't use it. And what I always give in terms of feedback to people that are still worried is that the core system, the core kind of dice roll, it can be used to suit almost every situation. And that is what you did for some of the bits where I was like, there's definitely a rule you could be using there. You just collapsed back to the core dice roll and went on that kind of triumph, conflict, disaster thing. And that with a twist, usually, almost always. And that was absolutely fine. It worked really well. Hearing the fully produced episodes, I don't know how much was going to cut out, how much table talk there was, et cetera, et cetera. But it flowed really well. And I think that's one of the most important things.
Mm.
The only thing that... the only thing I will say is there was one bit of terminology that annoyed me every time I heard it when used it.
Oh,
only one. Only one, though. No.
It's going to be the most common thing we said, I guarantee it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's so close to being the most common. It's the use of the word success. Because the Wild Seed technically does have success and not success as a binary thing. If you're rolling a 3, a 2, or a 1, it's not a success. You have not been successful. If you're rolling a 4, a 5, or a 6, it is a success. Something has been successful. But throughout the book, I have avoided, in almost all cases, apart from for a very few specific aspects that care about that kind of 3-4 boundary, using the word success in a mechanical term. Because disaster for 1, 2, and 3, conflict for 4 and 5, and triumph for 6 is stronger language. So every time you said, well, it's a success with a conflict or a success with a downside, I was just thinking, no, it's just a conflict. But that really was the only bit of terminology that repeatedly came up that I was like, I would definitely have pointed that out if I was in the room. Oddly enough, the one you didn't screw up in that exactly same terminology bracket was when you ended up rolling like 3, 2, and 1. You most often, every now and then it was a failure, which is, I don't like the Wild Seed, but most often you use disaster, which is exactly what it is. Or it didn't have to name it at all, because if one went, oh, so you didn't really have to say the word in the first place. And again, multiple times sixes were rolled, they were called out as a triumph or a success with a triumph. Like literally, apart from that, terminology-wise, you did great. So that was my only real bugbear. And if that's the worst thing I have to complain about you know, multiple hours of fully musicked and produced audio content for a thing I created and had no input in those multiple hours for, then I think you did pretty well.
I think just now is when I just learned that it wasn't success with a conflict.
That is interesting though, because it's a small point, but it is like a really powerful point of when you say success, it's immediately a binary of success and failure. Totally. But when you have three different levels of it, then you stop thinking of it in that way.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
It's one of those things. It helps define also the difference between conflict and triumph, because a triumph could be a full success, and that's kind of what it is. And a conflict is a partial success, because that's kind of what it is. But in terms of the actual language used, conflict and triumph, there is leagues between them in how that kind of sounds to the ear and works through the brain. Because a triumph is like, oh, wow, this has gone incredibly well. And a conflict is, okay, we've got something to work through here. And that is a much bigger difference than partial success and success.
Totally. That makes a lot of sense. I like that.
I do things with intentionality sometimes, not often. A lot of it just happens, but like sometimes.
Words are important in writing. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
There is another mechanic that is the most notable mechanic that we really played with, which was the whisper mechanic.
Yep. No, all that stuff, no problem at all. You nailed that stuff. Even if you weren't always doing it right, you still nailed it. I mean.
I want to take a second to talk about whispers, because it's such like a big part of this game. And I think, Elliot, I actually want to start with you. That whisper mechanic is so player forward. Mm. It's so like you have cut, we get whispers.
Right. And twists.
And twists. We get more stuff than you. but I guess you get to control the world. How did you feel? Because I know whispers was like a bit of a worry for you going into the season. How did you feel once you started using them, and then by the end of the season, how did you feel about them?
I mean, whispers was one of those things where it was like I was both nervous and extremely excited about using them. Like, I wanted to make sure that I encouraged their use and you know, introduce them. And I think where I came down was just like, let's just like kind of hand them out like candy, you know, throughout. And I ended up, I think it was the it really started to sing for me, I think, in the second episode of like when people started to really make use of them, where I was like, oh, OK, like I get how this plays out when somebody throws a whisper out there. Like, this is really cool. This is where I take a little bit of a step back and let them like change something in a big way and then contextualize it. So I ended up really it was my favorite part of, I think, the system was like when people got to use their whispers. It was like a, it was a moment for us to collaborate like real directly on something that is like traditionally GME, I guess, in other games.
And then Felix, our Elliot's addition in the whisper mechanic of the like whisper, say, and shout becoming a randomized thing once the Howl Eternal kind of took hold of the world. What did you think of that mechanic kind of as a designer? Like, were you excited by that?
Oh, yeah, super, super there for it. As soon as it was explained. Or I think you actually, I don't think you did explain it. I think you talked about it off camera or off kind of audio and then said, we have decided we're doing this thing. This is the example of this thing. The first time it's used. And I was like, hey, that introduces it just as well. It gives a good kind of in situ playthrough example. I loved it because it suited the kind of antagonist, I guess is not quite the right word, but antagonist-ish thing. Mm-hmm. Leviathan, there you go. Scary thing. A scary, howling, evil beast thing. It suited that perfectly. And it suited the fact that whispers took... I'm going to democratically and gently say a much bigger role in your game than they do in most games of the Wild Sea. And I think that is because you have single-handedly redressed the resource use across all Wild Sea games played in the history of the world with how many times you used whispers. and believe me, that is not a problem for me in the slightest. In fact, I love it because people are generally quite shy to use whispers. Mm. One of the, I do try and hold myself accountable for this stuff as well. One of the mistakes I made with the Wild Sea core book was I didn't make it clear enough how whispers were essentially just as, although more in setting kind of quote unquote powerful than the other resources, they were just as fluid. They were things that you gained and used and lost. And like one of the things I didn't point out enough in that was to put it a better way, if salvage and specimens and to an extent charts were like your potions and ethers, whispers were the elixir, the thing you hang on to until like the very end of a game. Because, right. You know.
And then you beat the boss and you're like, oh, wait, I didn't use my elixir.
And you're like, why have I got 12 elixirs in my inventory? Like, yeah. But you did them as if they were just another resource. In fact, you focused on them more than the other resources. And that was really, really refreshing. And I think the overall, other than the fact that I enjoyed the story and the drama and everything else, mechanically, the thing I think you did best was showcase whispers as a mechanic for not just changing the direction of, but often adding to and bringing the focus onto certain things in the story. So I think he did that really well. And the extra mechanics, adding an element of kind of randomness to how whispers come out, even when they're used, fitted that perfectly, fitted the antagonist, fitted the tone of the game, and fitted the play style of the table. Because you had a very adaptable set of players who could go in with, I have the intention of doing this, but I know that's it might not work out that way. And then you could talk through, well, it could be this, this, or this. I think this sounds good. Oh, let's fix it with this. Okay, let's go. The bits that often slow tables down, especially tables that aren't as used to fiction first stuff, are the bits that you went through at a really good pace, where you got to hear the creative process but not get bogged down in it. So, yeah, one of my favorite things. I loved your presentation of whispers.
That's I'd love to hear that, and thank you, because like I said, like, it was my favorite aspect of the game, like, mechanically to play with. It's totally, you're exactly right about like the adaptability of the table being so important to like having the permission for me as a GM to be like, hey, like, let's randomize this thing. And I think I talk about this in one of our talkbacks, but like, when one of the realities of like making a show versus playing a home game is that, you know, pacing is even more important because we need to like consider like listener perspective and audience perspective. That's always top of mind. And that was one of the benefits that the whisper mechanic didn't emerge because of a production need or want, but it ended up being a production benefit because it helped keep things moving rather than people like mulling over that decision. It like gave that like randomization where they had the opportunity.
It is also like a real element of following what the players were most excited about, because I think there's also a world where we play the Wild Sea and like charts are have the level of whispers, you know, for our game. Like, oh, it's all about finding the trade routes and, you know, finding El Dorado or, you know, some type of thing. And it's cool that very quickly, I think our group was like, ooh, whisper, what are these things? And it's like, okay, there's a lot of different, you know, mechanics that we can play with. That's the one that people are excited about. Let's focus on it. The other ones will still exist and we'll play around with them. But like, let's really, you know, turn the dial up on this one and see what happens when we do that.
Session zero was big for direction for the whole. I mean, like, you can hear it. I kind of want to go back now that the season's done and listen to our session zero. But like, I think so much of that.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
Oh, yeah.
Honestly, it's literally 5 minutes into session zero on my phone in the other room. Because I was like, now I've listened to the whole thing. I want to do that second zero session.
Oh, zero I should do it too. Maybe I'll do that right after this. I bet like, I just feel like so much of that was like people were interested in whispers. They were interested in Leviathans. Like they were interested in things that made the Wild Sea weird. Like the capital W weird was kind of like the big focus for the players and the big focus for me as the GM. And then this is maybe like getting ahead on things we're going to talk about. But like the decision to make their engine the Leviathan heart was the story. And it was just that's just like right out of the book, which is awesome.
Yeah. And actually, kind of looking at the session zero, Felix, in our initial interview, you gave Elliot three pieces of advice that we used, and I'd love to talk through those things, because I think it really reflects of like, if you do these three things, I think it's going to serve you really well, as Felix, you knew, and now we too know. The three pieces of advice were make the ship first rather than the characters. Use cut liberally, which as a player I can attest Elliot certainly did.
What?
Recut that one time, my guy, motherfucker, that's crazy. And then give NPCs whispers, which came at three pretty major points of the story in the very first scene in the third episode and in the one of the very last scenes of the finale.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm assuming everything hit like there are no spoiler warnings for everything. Everything is completely open.
Spoilers are abound.
Yeah. Good. I just wanted to check before I say you gave a squirrel a whisper. Like, that was,
I didn't give a squirrel a whisper. I think Brian gave a squirrel a whisper in a twist.
Sorry, a squirrel was given a whisper.
So squirrel was given a whisper to transform into a Leviathan. What's weird about that?
Nothing. It was brilliant. Very wild scene.
I do love the cut advice, though. I feel like that was like the advice that played the most for me that you gave in our interview. It felt bad.
Okay. Cut is bad and I hate it.
Counterpoint. I think that cut encouraged you all to use your goodies more than you would have otherwise. Like, not to say that like you wouldn't have, definitely, but it was like when you knew there was two cut, you were like, how can I use this aspect and like use teamwork and like all of these like fun interpretations of stuff.
Teamwork, that was the one I really, really liked. You often, when there was no cut, there wasn't much mechanical teamwork. There was lots of interplay between characters, but not much mechanical teamwork. As soon as cut came into things, you tended to say, could I help with this? Could I grant an advantage from doing such and such? And that was really lovely to see. Because it's not that cut is there to drive that kind of interaction. Cut is there, as we all know, as a stick to beat the players with repeatedly. Cut is there merely to represent.
You heard it here.
I have the bruises, Felix.
In actuality, cut is there because doing levels of difficulty, especially situational difficulty, can be quite hard, especially if it feels like they drain dice pools down to nothing. I've never liked that feeling in dice pool based game. And cut can still drain results pools down to nothing, or almost nothing, but you still get to roll the clicky clacky dice, and that feels nice, even if that nice feeling is only there for a fraction of a second before all those high results are ripped away from you by the cruel hubris of the Firefly.
There was a point in the finale where I rolled, I think, 5, maybe 6 dice, and 2 of them were 6s, and the cut was 2, and I had to look at them, get excited, and then get mad. But I will say, what I love about cut, and what I love about the advantages in the dice pool system, and that you get to roll all the dice, is that it scratches the itch in me that is... Anyone who listened to this season in particular, or listened to like our Patreon content or anything where I'm a player, my favorite phrase as a player is point of order. And I want to haggle for the extra advantage and the extra little bit. And cut gave me a really good reason to do so. Oh, yeah. In a way that's very fun.
It's also my favorite meta table talk bit of the season was the antagonistic relationship, particularly between me and you, about adding dice to your pool.
There's that great bit in the season of I'm like, can I just do more? And you're like, you have 6 dice. What more can you do? No, I love it. I love antagonizing you in particular.
One of the things I actually really enjoyed was that the use of cut for, because the first session, the first non-session zero session, was almost perpetually for the entire session a really dangerous situation. And cut was used really liberally really early on, which again is quite rare. You didn't ease people into things, which I quite liked. But then it actually highlighted the more normal sections as in, oh, this feels a lot safer. This feels nicer. And then when cut comes back in, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that. And as a listener, when you brought cut back in, I think the first time you brought cut back in like in a heavy way was like session 4 maybe. Okay. 3 or 4, it was old Ornail coming through the roof, and that it was that whole
thing.
Where suddenly it's like, oh yeah, things are really bad now. Like when Cut comes back in for that kind of thing, I was like, yeah, now I remember it. Now I know how it feels. And it reminded me of my times as a player, which I don't get to do very much. But those times of like when I'm looking at the Firefly going, why did I put this in the game? It's feel, oh, I hate this. But then as soon as you hear it from the other side, you're just like, oh, I feel so goddamn dramatic. I love it. Because it's not my dice.
It's a great tool for AP. I mean, like, it was just like great to like add the drama. Yeah.
It is a great, I feel like, a lot of dice pool games don't necessarily have that built-in way of saying, like, here's the difficulty class, like, here's the DC, where, like, cut really gives you that feeling of, you know, in a D&D type game, when someone says DC is 20, you're like, oh no, that feels bad.
And it's not the binary of advantage, disadvantage. It's, like, levels of disadvantage,
if disadvantage could get worse.
Right.
Actually, I don't know if that's one of the things I really liked, was... that when you did use that 3 cut, and I think even in the book, I think it says 3 cut is the highest cut you should consider using. If it's more than a 3 cut, you probably shouldn't be rolling in the first place, because it's just going to be too hard. Like, you're going to fail it. Statistically, you're almost always going to fail a cut of 4, even if you're rolling a 6 die. Like, right. It's just numbers. But a 3 cut is just within the realms of possibility of succeeding in like, I might get a conflict, I might get a triumph, like a genuine 4, 5, or 6 success. Even if it's a success with a conflict.
I'm glad you said that, because our listener couldn't see the aggressive air quotes you put around success.
But one of the things I really liked is that oftentimes when you said, like, when people would occasionally ask, the players would ask, like, is there a cut? And you'd be like, well, probably a cut of 1. And it would be like, that's a thing you all get at that point. Like, cut of 1, fair enough, we can do this. Cut of 2, that felt special. And when that cut of 3 came in, even though in terms of the kind of gradation of numbers, it's literally 1, 2, and 3. That 3, the horror in the voices of the players as you said the word 3, and they're like, 3?
Like, that's not a number.
Yeah. It was that felt good. That felt good for a designer. I like that.
That was almost like, the cut of 3 there was me trying to put up like, warning, do not enter, do not go this way. Because I think Abby, to remind the listener of what this cut of 3 was, Abby wanted to hop aboard the Leviathan Bat Dragon Clarabelle, fly, grab the heart, the central object of this, as a town port-sized Leviathan was trying to get the same thing, and then fly around it.
Don't get me wrong. Very dramatic moment.
Very dramatic.
Would have been amazing. And the disaster that would have inevitably come.
Right. It would have been tragic. But yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like the other key piece of advice that like we really loved in Session Zero was the make the ship first. That really gave structure to the Session Zero in a way, and gave us, I think, most acutely the gift that was Bats as a character. I think would not have happened without making the ship first, and for that we thank you.
I'm glad it went well. Yeah,
we got the central thesis of the story with the heart. We got Izora's relationship with Clarabelle, which wasn't like a big thing, but did like really define her a lot.
Totally.
Oh, you talked about complaints earlier. That was my biggest complaint. I'm sorry, not enough Clarabelle.
Not enough Clarabelle. That's true. I did realize like there was one episode where Clarabelle wasn't around, and I got to the end of it and I was like, what's Clarabelle been doing this whole time? Because I liked Clarabelle a lot. I just never remembered to use her.
Then to me, oddly enough, to me as a designer, that's a flag for something I should address in the future, because one of the things that we're doing with the next book is rules for mounts. And Clarabelle is the kind of thing that would work perfectly, not just as a ship component, which she was, but as an actual mount, something which could leave the ship and be there with their own little kind of rules package of like, hey, we can affect a scene with this in this particular way. Here's how it's written down. And also have all the role play stuff on top of it, and also have the ship part of it. So it's something that hearing the way a kind of element of the world like Clarabelle was used was actually really helpful to me in a completely non-fun context. Not that it wasn't fun to listen to, but it became like, that's a bit of work. I can note down like, these are the things that I should be doing in the future with X, Y, Z. Just very useful. Unexpectedly useful. I know it wasn't what you're aiming for at all. No kudos there, but great job.
You don't get credit for accidents.
I am curious, Felix, just on kind of extending that thread a little bit. Was there anything else from this series that you took away as a designer that was like, ooh, this is a thing that I want to highlight more in future book? Maybe this is a thing I want to downplay in future books, or like, here's a brand new idea for something.
Well, I can give you a proper answer to this, actually. While listening, I did start my listening while walking, because I'm trying to do the whole be vaguely healthy, don't live behind a desk thing at the moment, which involves going out in the sunshine, which is a new experience for me. And while walking, it was good to be able to stick something in my ears and listen to that was still work-related, so I didn't feel like I was, you know, just shirking what I do for the rest of the day. But while walking, I got to just listen for pleasure, which was nice. But while I was listening to it while kind of eating, which I do at the same desk as everything else happens in the house, I ended up opening up a document and starting a little kind of running section of like a little companion piece of just like two pages of rules and aspects and stuff for my first dungeon. And one of the things that got put down there was, of course, a very handsome coat as a specific new aspect.
Hell yeah.
The ability to appear behind someone's shoulder and scare the hell out of them. That's down there. I don't know why it stood out so much in my head, but the grave jar maracas is what I've written them down as. But just like, it's a jar with bones in it. And it's a maraca that doesn't actually get played during the song, which is, I don't know why, but I love that so much. So there's lots of little kind of aspecty bits that got written down there. But mechanically speaking, the bit that I put down as a section to kind of, and I've even written an example for, is interlinked resources, I think I wrote it down as. The concept of the, like, oh, we've got these copper rings and we've got these lenses, put them together and they make this thing. Mm. And listening to that happen and listening to the crew responses to that, like, as I point out in the newly written interlinked resources section, which will probably just be released like as a thing to the Discord or something for people, is like you can combine anything, really, but some things do belong together. Some things are designed to go together. And in those cases, when you combine them, instead of getting a new resource and having to roll, you don't have to roll, and you instead get a small but valuable piece of cargo, which also counts as the both of the two different kinds of resources you've mixed together.
Mm.
So it's a way to potentially get more stakes for your ship. It's a way for the Firefly to introduce things that snap together in a way that makes players go, oh, that's cool. And it doesn't have a skill ceiling to it. It's just like these things belong together and they are now a cool new thing, which is quite flexible. So it's a small change, but it's a genuine mechanical thing that now exists in the real world as a direct consequence of listening to the show. So well done, I guess.
Hell yeah.
That's cool as hell.
I also realized I should probably increase the font size of conflict by about kind of 18, 20. So it just stands out bigger on the page.
Or put in parentheses, not a fucking success.
Really, it's in parentheses, not a fucking success, comma, Elliot.
Yeah, right.
Or theoretically, actually do kind of lean harder into it and point out that there is a metric of success and not success, and that these results count as a success, and that might have a mechanical kind of benefit or drawback depending on a particular aspect. But that these things, these three bands on those same results are kind of the ones you call out.
Right.
So
right.
That might be a thing that changes writing wise in the future. Who knows? I might just learn to live with it, but I might make something of it.
I do also just want to tell a quick aside about the bone maracas. I was sound designing and I kept looking up maraca sounds and I couldn't find anything that sounded anything like a bone maraca. So I went and got like a bunch of pots and pans and stuff from our kitchen and threw a bunch of dice in them and was just shaking them in front of our in front of my microphone. And Abby comes over and she goes, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm making Azora's bone maraca." And she goes, "You know, our downstairs neighbor is like a musician. I'm sure she has maracas." And I turned around and like shouted, "It's not a maraca, it's a bone rattle." She very quietly retreated into the bedroom.
Weirdly enough, I was going to ask about the sound design of two things.
Yeah.
One was the maracas, because I listened to that and I thought, that's a great sound. Is that dice?
Oh, yeah. It's dice inside of a ceramic pot.
Good. I'm so glad it's dice. But the second one was Clarabelle, because I'm assuming it was just like a, it's just a person. But
it's me.
With some filters and effects and things on stop. Yeah, well, there you go. But it was a really good sound. It was a really good, distinct sound that sounded different to everything else in the thing that was a creature, which was really good. So, yeah,
It is, Elliot, you have that moment, I think, it's in episode 6 when Azorius is like, "We fly now." And you go, mm. I was like, oh, yes. Yeah, I think it's, you know, for anyone who's interested in the audio thing, I'm pretty sure Clarabelle is Elliot's voice pitched a little bit down with some kind of flanger on it. Which is basically just the thing that makes, you know, something sound wonky and weird. And then maybe a little bit more distortion from something. And I think like a little bit of reverb. And then I boost the low end to make it sound bigger.
There's one sound that I want to call out also that I did live in session for listeners because they might not think it. When the Leviathan skeleton laughs at you guys in episode 6, I did that on mic in the moment and got just the most frightened looks from all the players. And I just want people to know that was a live moment.
It was great. I remember it in moment. I was like, terrifying. And I know exactly how to make that sound even worse.
Yeah.
I was going to congratulate you on obviously finding a real squirrel to record for your squirrel sounds because they were so accurate.
Man, coming for
Elliot. Am I too sarcastic? That's okay.
Damn, man. It was the hardest thing. Every time Ahab showed up, I was like, "Fuck, God, fucking damn it! I don't know what a squirrel sounds like. I don't know how to do that." Should have just given him a little cute voice. It should have just been like a, yeah, like something like that. That would have been.
I think by the end, I find, because like early on, I think I didn't find anything. And then later on, I found like some scampering sounds and I was like, close enough.
I think it was my brain wanting chittering and not knowing how to make chittering that I just like got stuck in this feedback loop every time Ahab came up where I was just like, he makes a squirrel noise. You know what I mean? It's the best. It's, you know, that's the fun of when you're thinking about sound design while GMing. that is very fun.
But again, I will point out, as hypercritical as I am of everything and everyone, The fact that these are the things that I bring up to point out is you did a fantastic job, all of you as players, and you particularly as a Firefly. And the sound design, you did a great job as well. You really, and the tree shanties. God,
the tree shanties. Yeah.
We can talk about the tree shanties. Yeah.
Oh no! Before we do though, what was that other one thing? The Leviathan heart arrhythmia.
That was a good one. Ezra wraps the rope around.
Oh yeah.
Yep. And that was one of the few moments where you specifically called out, like, I'm really sorry, sound design on this is going to be, it's like, yeah, I bet it is. The heart makes a sound no heart has ever made before. Great.
To be fair, like at the beginning of every season, I tell the players and the Firefly and the GM, hey, do whatever you want. Like, say whatever crazy thing you want. Like, we will support it from a sound. Like, whatever you bring into the world will be made real. And the great thing about that is players make big swings and they say crazy things and then we get to rise to the occasion. The problem with it is, boy, how do they set that bar at Olympic levels sometimes?
But you meet it every damn time, I will say.
I think the one I didn't do from this season was the heartbeat, like sound, like being noise
being
and then anti-noise.
Yes.
And I was like, I tried it. I spent like an hour trying to do it and I was like, it doesn't sound like what I want it to sound like. So I'm just going to do a heart. People will get it. People will forget.
100%.
I did love that part.
Rom-Com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about meet-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-Com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom, or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Speak into the void. You never know who may be listening. In the Annie Award-winning Void 1680 AM, you take on the role of a late-night radio DJ. Use a standard poker deck and a six-sided die to build your playlist, interact with callers, and assemble a show that expresses something about why you love the music that you do. Void 1680 AM includes rules for single session and ongoing play, so you can develop the relationships of your DJ with your callers over time. You can even join the growing community of affiliate DJs whose shows are broadcast live on air and on YouTube. Shop Void 1680 AM now at bannerless.games/shop and take 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON. Again, that's 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON.
Yeah, the sound design in general was, it gave it, like, I cannot give you more congratulations than I don't have the words to give you the congratulations I want to give you. It made it so much more immersive than a lot of actual play stuff. Not even just the wildly actual play stuff I have listened to from others. And a lot of these did have sound design of some kind, but the caliber of your sound design, and I guess this is actually a direct compliment, matches the caliber of your role playing and teamwork, and that is something which rarely happens. I just thought it was brilliant. So yeah,
hell yeah.
See, I can give a compliment sometimes. You know, this doesn't happen
we'll
often.
That. Brian is a genius. I will say that on mic always.
Well, honestly, I think the thing that's great about the thing that I love about what we do is that, kind of like I said before, I tell people we bring all the stuff together so that everything has to rise to the occasion. So like, we picked the Wild Sea because we were incredibly excited about the Wild. Like, we saw the book at Gen Con last year. A lot of stuff happened at that like one Roan, Rook, and Deckard party at Gen Con last year. We saw the book. We're like, oh my God, this is amazing. Look at this. And we were talking about it for a while and then reached out to you and made this thing happen. Then we bring in players who are like incredible and are going to like elevate the game. And then we bring in a Firefly who's going to like elevate the game. And then we tell everyone, do anything you want. We'll have to match it. And the thing that we want to do is take a game like Wildstead, which you know, isn't Dungeons and Dragons. It doesn't have that like wide scope of things, and give it that like dimension 20, that, you know, that crazy treatment, so that people are all of a sudden like, oh, I didn't know how much I wanted this. And I feel like we did it this season. I think, yeah, we do it most seasons, but I feel we really nailed it this season.
No, you definitely did it.
And also, yeah, when in one of the first pages of the book, you say the phrase tree shanties, you ruined me. You ruined me.
Brian had a whole different character concept, and then he said, and then he read the phrase tree shanties.
And I was like, oh, I want to be a good boy who sings songs.
Weirdly enough, the phrase tree shanties actually came from the Discord community way back in the earliest days.
Hell yeah.
Because I was talking on there about songs and sea shanties, because a weird deep cut here. I hate sea shanties. I don't know why. I just hate them. It's just one of those weird things. I don't know. They do not sit right with me in terms of like an audio experience. But take away all the water and add leaves. And someone on the Discord pointed out, like, well, they wouldn't even be sea shanties. Like, even though it's the wild sea, you just call them tree shanties. And I was like, you've got it. And I can't remember who that is, because that was like 5 years ago. And it took years to get into the book after that. And like, because there are some elements of the book that they exist because of the community. And some elements of the book that exist because a particular person said a particular thing or used a particular thing in a test game or at like a particular time or in a conversation. Like the concept of calling the sea the lignin tide, just as one of the many, many different names, because I say rustling waves is my go-to. Other people say different things. But Rick, the head of playtesting, he's played more Wild Sea than anyone else in the world, I think. And he likes the phrase lignin tide. And it wasn't in the first book, I don't think, but it is in the second book, specifically because I've now seen other community members say, no, on the lignin tie. And it's like, oh, God, everyone's using it now. I have to use it myself. So it's one of those things where the writing becomes informed by the community around it. And tree shanties is probably the earliest example of that. I just can't remember the specific person. So whoever did tree shanties, the word tree shanties, well done.
If you're listening, reveal yourself. We want to give you your flowers.
And then just before we move away from tree shanties, I got to know, Felix, what was your favorite tree shanty from the season?
Oh, see, it's kind of an impossible one to answer, because they were all really good. I know that sounds like the weakest praise. They were all really good. But my favorite was the one from, I think it was episode 5, where you only get like a verse and a bit of the chorus in, and then it's interrupted.
Oh, give me a chart.
That, but I don't know if it was the tree shanty itself or the nature of the interruption that just nailed it for me. But that was one of the times where I burst out laughing as I was just walking down the street at like 11 p.m., which must have made me look like a crazy person. But, you know, it really, really made me laugh.
That was a great moment for me as a player, because for five episodes, I'd been conditioned that like, oh, when Brian and Jay do their shanty time, it's like that sacred time. We all listen to the shanty and it's great and we have fun. And then all of a sudden, episode 5, I'm just like, you know, in my mode, like not thinking about game, not like planning to react to anything. So I'm just like, oh, I'm doing my thing. No one's going to interrupt. And then Elliot jumps in and like the shock on my face was genuine, because I was like, what are you doing invading my shanty time?
That's the thing I was thinking as I was listening to it. I was like, I don't know how much of this is agreed beforehand, but that sounded like a genuine interruption.
Oh, yeah.
That one was super genuine.
It came across in the audio. And I think that's why I liked it so much. Because if you'd been doing the tree shanty knowing it was going to be stopped at that exact point, et cetera, I don't think it would have come across as genuine as it did.
Yeah, it set every player on edge exactly when I wanted them to be on edge. And it was funny because pre-recording, and this relates to a question from one of our Discord members, that Brian and Jay are generally singing the shanties at the table or playing like a demo version of it if they're not singing. And in that episode before recording, I said to Brian, I said, hey, Brian, give me a chart. How long is the runtime on that? And he was like, oh, it's like about a minute 30. I was like, okay, great. Okay, just noting that for me.
You also, and I don't know if you intended this, but you hit it on the best possible line in that song of your soul is not something with which you can barter. You barter with only the things that you own, which is the hardest line I've written for a tree shanty.
Yeah.
And that you cut it off right then. It's like, oh, fuck.
Love it. Right? I guess the other aspect, and this is going to sound again like fishing for compliments, but like it's the nature of this kind of talkback. I want to ask Felix how you felt seeing Storm and Root in play specifically, because that was one of the aspects that I know, like when we talked early, you wanted to highlight was like depth delving and this new expansion.
See, I think I'm beginning to suspect that you might be a glutton for punishment here, because as you called out in the episode itself, I think end of episode 3 or start of episode 4, maybe even start of episode 5, I can't remember, when you descended for the first time and brought the pressure mechanics into play, you were like, oh, Felix is going to hate this because the one bit of advice he specifically gives is don't do this thing that we're going to do right now. And then you sit here and you go, hey, Felix, how'd you feel about the inclusion of that thing? And it's like, well, to be honest,
well, I feel bad.
I think that's why it's worth talking about. That's why, warts and all, that's what we used to say on this show.
No, you did it really well. I have liked to see a more gradual descent that showed off the pressure mechanics in their entirety? Yes, I would. But was I pleased with how you represented it? Yes, actually, there was a specific moment, I think, where you went to pressure level 3 and you described like the warping of the deck and the changes of the, I think that was when the giant skull thing happened. That was you actually really captured that dramatic change of like, yeah, things are okay, but a bit dangerous, to like, oh, things are fucked. Like, oh God, yeah, this is bad. You captured that really well. So you actually did it in kind of exactly the way I'd have wanted to see it done. You just skipped out the intervening space of like, oh, things are getting a bit. You just went straight from that we're okay to, oh God.
It's all bad. Everything's bad.
But yeah, I think from the limited interaction with the precious stuff that there was time wise, I think you did a good job with it. The mechanic the thing from Storm and Rue that I enjoyed the most was seeing the Howl Eternal, because I've never seen the Howl Eternal in a game before. And it is not just one of my favorite things in Storm and Rue, but it was one of the most annoying pages to create in terms of page placement, because I am still kind of the learning stage of InDesign, even though I've done this for years now as a job, because a lot of what I do is the writing side of things, and the layout is alongside but still essentially secondary to that. And I was taught the kind of the basics of layout by Leo Blue 2 Days, creator of Passings, a lovely person. And what he gave me was like, this is how you do this is what you need for a book. And I was like, okay, I can do that. And now we're, you know, 2 books and 3-4 smaller supplements in. My needs have gone past that. And he decided to, you know, have a kid and be a real person and do real person things. So I was just left slowly learning how to do more stuff with InDesign. And one of the things I had to learn how to do was how to make it so that using the specific setup we've got, text in a box can be surrounded by an image that does not have. Yeah. It was absolute hell to try and make that page line up. Both for me and for Schmeckrell, the creature artist. And we went back and forth on that like 6 or 7 times with like minor adjustments, just to make it all line up properly. And it finally did, almost. That's one of those pages I look at and I can read it and I can love it and I can look at the picture and I can love it, but I cannot quite look at the bit where the picture meets that text box without going, next time. So listening to the Howl Eternal rather than seeing it. So yeah, listening to the Howl Eternal rather than seeing it. So much nicer, because I didn't have to see that bit of the page. So it's brilliant.
This, I think, really connects to like when one of the things that I was worried about when we first chatted in the interview was I was worried about over-prepping in a game that didn't want you to prep a lot. And you had given the advice, if you were like, flip through the book and find the like creatures and hazards that excite you and hold on to those. And I flipped through the main book and I flipped through Storm and Root, and the Howl Eternal just like leapt out of Storm and Root as like the thing where it was like, me, please use me. And I was like, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. I will. And yeah, it's such a juicy page to read. Like you get used to this format of like reading about the Leviathans and like the whispers they have and the sense and all that. And then you read the Howl Eternal and you're like, all this is just a little different and a little fucked up. Like, because this is like the depths of the depths Leviathan. Yeah. I just fell in love with that page and I was like, I have to use this. And then that and the heart became the central focus of the campaign.
The other thing I was going to say was that one of the other things you used was wretch beaks. You only use them as a kind of like a scene setting thing. The kind of vulture-y.
Right.
You had them as things kind of taken over. But wretch beaks themselves. I found that really interesting because wretch beaks are one of the few things in the Wild Sea that I didn't make myself. Wretch beaks were specifically one of the backer contributed hazards from the first book's Kickstarter campaign. And it was really nice to get a shout out.
Hell yeah.
So, I will pass on because I know exactly who made them. Actually, Spinch, one of our longtime mods. I will pass over to Spinch. Like, hey, Spinch, that thing you made, that's in a thing now. So yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Spinch.
It was really nice to see him.
They were great. They felt like just the right level of creepy to throw in as a visual sort of cue. That was great. That's awesome. I love that. I mean, I feel like this is disconnected a little bit from our season, but I do think this like Discord community, like as we've been posting about the season that you guys have cultivated and like you Felix have cultivated, is so strong. Like you just see people in there every day just talking about the coolest shit. It's the best.
Oh yeah, they're a lovely group. I can't take much credit for it these days, oddly enough. Back in the early days, I had to drive. This again 4 or 5 years ago now. I had to drive almost all the engagement myself, but now. The mods are fantastic, and not even just the mods, like the regular posters are so good at just driving community engagement that I think in the entire four and a half-ish years that the Discord's been up, we've had to ban like only two people or something outside of spam bots and whatever, you know. And in terms of act like moderator decision stuff, once or twice a year, if that, like, we just have a genuinely lovely community. And that's not a call out or a devil's advocate thing. Don't go make it worse, anyone, because it's great. But touch wood, it is the, and I say this without hyperbole, the nicest role playing game community I've ever seen. Because most seem full of people that you just wouldn't want to be in a room with. Online communities in general, kind of terrifying. I think we got really, really lucky. And I'd love to say, yeah, that's all me. But no, that's all the community itself. It is a really positive place that attracts lovely people. It's awesome. I'm really proud of it.
Hell yeah.
So you should go check out the Wild Sea Discord. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah.
Good place.
So as we come to a close on this episode, this talkback episode, and also this season of My First Dungeon, The Wild Sea, I just want to go around the horn here, go around the table, and talk about what are our favorite moments from this season. Elliot, you want to start us off?
It's easy and it's the most heartbreaking, and it's lament / saying goodbye to Cherry in episode 6.
Yeah.
Yeah, you did use the Wild Sea's kind of purposefully narrative first death mechanics extremely well. I was expecting one at the end, because I was not expecting two. Or technically like 4 or 5 or whatever it was in the end. It got pretty brutal to us.
Including NPCs, it was a lot of death. Yeah.
Oh, and the biggest tree. Oh.
Biggest tree. Oh. She's almost the biggest tree. I'm gonna go to me next just so we can end on you, Felix. I want to give all the flowers in the world to Azora's running bit of sneaking up behind me. It was the most fun I had in play. I loved it so much.
Yeah.
See, that's almost mine, because I try not to show any favoritism to anyone, but best character. Just no, sorry, everyone else. Also fantastic characters. Everyone, brilliant job. But the amount of times I got to have a genuine laugh with the interplay of Azora and anyone else when she was doing anything was just, oh, so good. The amount of bone-based jokes, it's just brilliant. But oddly enough, I think one of my favorite moments was with bats.
Mm.
Just climbing that rib cage for kind of no reason and then screwing everything up for kind of no reason. And I was listening thinking like, why though? I mean, it's great drama, but like, why? They're signs. They just talked about the signs. And then in my head, I was like, unless bats can't read. And then there's a group who are just like, probably can't read. getting to that moment and just having the same like thought flow through as the rest of you. It made me feel like I was part of the thing, which was a lovely feeling as I was listening. Oh, so,
hell yeah.
And it was just that was a great moment. But there were, to be fair, a lot of good moments. Almost, this is not to say all the other episodes are rubbish. They were fine. But like episodes, it was like 3 and 4, the very middle. So much stuff happened that was really, really damn cool in terms of like the interplay between characters. Because I guess as a group, you'd hit your stride. Mm-hmm. But story-wise, you hadn't gotten to the super big important stuff where everything was kind of coming to a head. So you had that kind of middle section. That middle section was so, so good for just character to character role play and character interacting with the world role play. I guess favorite moment, bats shouting at things, good. But also just those two episodes, just all of them.
Mm.
I do really want to, because we only had 6 episodes in this game, we didn't get to like really explore depth. We didn't get to really explore travel. There's like a lot of things that like mega campaigns get to do that I'm like, ooh, we've done the big highlights. I want to do some of the crunch and like live in travel or live in like building up resources and charts and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So you didn't ask me about my least favorite moments, because I could tell you what that is as well. Because that was the bit where on recording, you said, yeah, we were going to do another few episodes, but now we decided, yeah, now we're going to do it like this. Oh, brilliant. Thanks. Because I got so excited for like, 3 seconds? And then you just dashed my hopes against the rocks of failure. So, yeah.
You know, when the joy of games meets the reality of production, sometimes you truncate things and, it does make me want to run a home campaign of Wildseed, though. Like, that is, I think, a credit to the, you know, Brian, you asked me what I thought of the game. Like, a credit to any game we play is that, like, I just ran it for, you know, 2 months. And my first thought after was like, man, I'd love to then go and run this for, like, my home group, like, for another 6 months. And so that's like, yeah. I just want to live in all the little pockets of this world and go to the cactus sea, like all the different versions of the verdant sea in the book. Yeah, come on. We could do 10 seasons.
Actually, I had a question, not to muck up the ending of your show, which you've already kind of announced. So I'm just going to, I'm ruining everything now. If you weren't fireflying, what kind of thing would you have played?
Oh, wow. I would have been a Gao for sure. I wanted a mushroom person, I think, in the mix. And I just think that like getting to be a little mushroom dude is cool as hell. And in terms of like post, man, I like Char a lot, but I also like Screw. So I would probably be torn between Char and Screw for post.
Because one of the things that I thought as I was listening to it was like, it would be really good to see you as a player as well as just a Firefly, because you were brilliant as a Firefly. But being a Firefly, although you are playing the game, is obviously a very different experience to being a player. So if at some point you want to do like an extra one-off session or two-shot or something, and I'm happy to run it for a bit and you get to play something.
I would love that.
Hell yeah.
Because it would be lovely to play with the crew, even if it's not some big, like, very well produced thing. It would just be nice to kind of, in as much in person as over the internet gets, but kind of in person, congratulate people and interact with you guys, because you did a fantastic job.
Let's make it happen. That sounds like a blast. Yeah.
And now I have to do it because I said it on the thing.
Because you said it on my
thing. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, look to the My First Dungeon feed in the near future. And that is all for this season of My First Dungeon and our journey across the rustling waves. If you want your own journey on the Wild Sea, head on over to myth.works and be sure to use the promo code MYFIRSTDUNGEON for 20% off your order. If you want even more My First Dungeon, head on over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod to get bonus actual plays, cast talkbacks, all of the tree shanties from this season, and a whole lot more. And as always, remember, if you're having fun, you're already doing it right. Aye, aye, everybody.
Aye, aye.
Aye?
Aye? Thanks so much, Felix. This was great.
It was great. If you're looking for more great gaming content from everyone here at Many Sided Media, you should consider subscribing to the 20 Sided newsletter. It's a free, bi-monthly newsletter for people who love games, make games, and just love making games. To subscribe, just go to 20sidednewsletter.substack.com or follow the link in the show notes.